dodges. I ride in this wind on my good horse. I call you my shiny black bears to the playhouse of fortune to take the bright silver and gold you have taken from somebody.
You're tuned to WEOS Geneva, WXXE Fenner, Syracuse, W201CD Ithaca Community Radio, Free Radio Santa Cruz, or KFAR Knoxville. This is Unwelcome Guests. I'm Lynn Gary. Longtime listeners to the program may remember that we once featured a long interview done by TUC Radio's Mariah Gallardon with Dr. Ignacio Chapella, a University of California, Berkeley ecologist who discovered that genes from genetically engineered corn had been found contaminating ancient strains of corn in remote areas in Oaxaca, Mexico. Chapella, who's been an outspoken critic of the financial influence of biotechnology corporations at the university, was recently denied tenure, though his discovery may be one of the most ecologically significant in recent years. The suspicious circumstances surrounding the denial of Chapella's tenure serves as a real-life demonstration of the critique of the academic system that produces society's intellectual workers that Jeff Schmidt has laid out in his book, Disciplined Minds, that we've been reading on the show weekly since last October. For those joining the program this week for the first time, Disciplined Minds makes the case that the role of professionals in society is ideological as well as technical, and that the system of training and credentialing is fundamentally concerned with producing intellectual workers who have the proper professional attitude, that is, who will be obedient servants of the corporate-controlled social hierarchy, and who won't use their skills, creativity, and social prestige to challenge the established order. Last week, I began reading from Chapter 8, in which Schmidt describes in detail the specific stages of professional training of a physicist to show how the desired mental attitude is inculcated. It's a long and powerfully written chapter, and I've decided to read the rest of it in one go on this week's program in order to give you the full impact of the psychological brutality involved. This reading will take up the last hour and a quarter of the program. I also thought a bit of humor was called for, and it gives me the opportunity to play something I've been hanging on to for a while. A talk by David Rees, the cartoonist behind the satirical strip, Get Your War On. I'll start out, though, by reading you a brief article on the case of Ignacio Chapella from the January 9th Chronicle of Higher Education. The author of the piece is Sharon Walsh. The University of California at Berkeley has denied tenure to Ignacio H. Chapella, an assistant professor of ecology and an outspoken critic of the university's ties to the biotechnology industry. The professor and other scientists critical of academic links to corporations and of genetically modified crops have anxiously awaited the tenure decision for 3 years. My immediate reaction was extreme disappointment in the chancellor, said Mr. Chapella, who joined the university's Department of Environmental Science, Policy, and Management in the fall of 1995. I hoped he could see the evidence and take his role as a leader, he said, of Robert M. Berdahl, the chancellor. The university's decision, which was first reported in the December 11th issue of the British journal Nature, overruled recommendations for tenure by a faculty committee in Mr. Chapella's department and by an ad hoc panel of specialists in his field. A committee of the Academic Senate had recommended against tenure. Mr. Chapella and his research became controversial when he published an article in Nature in November 2001 that said that native corn in Mexico had been contaminated by material from genetically modified corn. a 1998 law had made it illegal to plant transgenic corn in Mexico. 6 months after the article appeared, and after receiving a number of letters contesting the research, the journal published an editorial note saying that, quote, "The evidence available is not sufficient to justify the original paper," close quote, and that the editors wanted to, quote, "allow our readers to judge the science for themselves," close quote. Mr. Chappella said at the time he suspected he was the target of pro-industry scientists and of the biotechnology industry itself. He'd been a vocal critic of a deal the university made in 1998 with Novartis, a Swiss-based biotechnology company, in which the company paid Berkeley $5 million each year for 5 years in exchange for early review of all proposed publications and presentations by faculty members whose work the company supported. George A. Strait, Jr., Assistant Vice Chancellor for Public Affairs, said he was surprised that the news media would be interested in Mr. Chappella's case. "He didn't get tenure, period," Mr. Strait said. Berkeley's tenure process, he added, is, quote, "among the most strenuous, the most fair, and the toughest in the country. No one person, no one institution, no one group has any undue influence," close quote. Mr. Chappella's findings, made with a graduate student, David Quist, and reported in the 2001 article about Mexican maize, were important and controversial for several reasons. First, agricultural companies that have produced genetically modified plants have said that the engineered material does not travel from one field to another. Second, Mr. Chappella and Mr. Quist contended that the transfer genes that appeared in the genetic material of native Mexican corn were multiplying and hopping around inside the plant's genome, which could interfere with the normal functioning of other genes. This opens up the whole question of what happens in the next generation of transgenics, he said. The finding means there is no control, especially in plants that are wind-pollinated, like corn. Mr. Chappella had been unanimously recommended for tenure by his department's tenure committee. The decision then went on to a committee of the Academic Senate, which appointed the ad hoc group of specialists to give an opinion. The ad hoc committee, whose membership is normally secret, unanimously said tenure should be granted, according to Wayne M. Goetz, a professor of environmental science who identified himself as a member of that committee after he found out that Mr. Chappella was not getting tenure. "I've been here 24 years, and my understanding is that if the department and the ad hoc committee recommend for tenure, you get tenure," he said. Mr. Goetz wrote a letter to the Vice Chancellor for Academic Affairs questioning the process, and sent copies of the letter to the ad hoc committee members. The chairman of the ad hoc committee then notified Mr. Goetz that the Senate's committee had asked him to reconvene the ad hoc committee to review Mr. Chappella's research again. At that point, Mr. Goetz says, the chairman resigned and disavowed the committee's report, saying he did not have the expertise to judge Mr. Chappella's research. The chairman, whose name Mr. Goetz declined to reveal, did not tell any of the members of the committee about his decision at the time, Mr. Goetz said. The Senate's committee then advised the chancellor to reject Mr. Chappella's tenure bid, which the chancellor did. "I have no direct evidence of anything," Mr. Chappella said of the chancellor's decision, "but the crown jewel of Burdall's chancellorship is a bioengineering building. There's still an enormous amount of animosity against me because of my criticism of Novartis," Mr. Chappella said. "I cannot help but think that this influenced the decision on tenure." And that was from the Chronicle of Higher Education, January 9, 2004. Berkeley denies tenure to ecologist who criticized university's ties to the biotechnology industry, by Sharon Walsh. David Reese's expletive-filled satirical cartoon Get Your War On started as a private joke and propelled him to stardom. Community radio producer George King recorded a presentation by Reese last March at the University of Connecticut, which he was able to produce for radio, on which we are prohibited from using the type of language that Reese, as well as most other people, use on a daily basis in real life. Amazingly, George managed to do this without destroying the feel of the original. So, enjoy.
The artist began publishing his satirical commentaries with the beginning of the U.S. bombing of Afghanistan, and the comic strip quickly became a popular stop for web surfers. Get Your War On has been picked up for publication in Rolling Stone magazine, and the first several months of strips have been collected into a book. Royalties from the sales of this book are donated to a program to remove landmines in Afghanistan. The book is published by Soft Skull Press. In his appearance at the University of Connecticut, David Reese told the story behind his work and shared some of his views regarding current events.
So this is a series of comics that I started making in October of 2001. Initially, I posted them on my website, just kind of for myself and then for my friends, and then it gradually, or by gradually, I mean immediately, turned into this big thing that went all over the internet, and now it's been published in a book form, a collection of these comics, by this publisher based in New York City called Soft Skull Press. So they publish the book, and then they send me around to events like these to show you some of the comics. I realize, as well as you do, that everything I'm about to say or show you these comics is totally out of date because, of course, we've moved on to the next war. And this book came out when people still could find Afghanistan on a map, which I guess is no longer the case. So I didn't really have time to make that to bring so many of the comics about the current situation in Iraq. But anyway, so this is going to be a somewhat nostalgic evening when we'll recall bombing campaigns of months past rather than bombing campaigns, you know, that are around the corner. Okay. And the only other thing that I want to say before I get started, for those of you who aren't familiar with this comic, is that one of the things about it is that it has a lot of profanity in it. And I always like to just say before I begin, if there's anyone who's truly offended by profanity, there's a fair warning for you because it does have a lot of profanity in it, and I'm happy to talk about why that's the case or whatever. But I don't want to, like, poke my thumb in anyone's eye, so to speak. Okay. I wanted to start, actually, to give you, because this is an academic institution, I wanted to give you some kind of, like, context or historical background so you can get a sense of the tradition that I've been working in with my computer clip art satirical cartoons by showing you some computer clip art satirical cartoons actually from the 19th century. Which was this strip that ran years and years ago called Get Your Civil War On. And I found in my grandmother's attic. And it's obviously about the Civil War. The guy says, holy shit, the southern states are seceding. I heard they're even going to print up their own money. Ha! Stupid fake-ass southern money. Maybe they can use their fake money to rebuild Atlanta after we burn it to the ground. There is another one that wasn't destroyed in the fire. I'll show you that one. This is from the spring of 1861. He says, oh man, I've been looking at those Matthew Brady daguerreotypes of battlefields. That is no joke. I wonder how many people are going to die in this civil war. 10,000 or 15,000? Holy f***. What if the death toll reaches 20,000? He says, if the death toll reaches 20,000, I'll say, congratulations, death toll, you're 1/30th of the way there. Because 600,000 people died in that war, amazingly. Okay, so that's the historical background. Let's focus now on what I did within that tradition. This was posted, this is the first night of me making these comics. It was like 2 in the morning on October 9th of 2001. Here's the one that kind of started the whole thing off. He says, oh yeah, Operation Enduring Freedom is in the house. Oh yeah, Operation Enduring Our Freedom is in the motherfucking house. Yes, Operation Enduring Our Freedom to Bomb the Living Fuck Out of You is in the house. That's where it all began. Okay. This is more work from the same night. He says, oh my God, this war on terrorism is going to rule. I can't wait until the war is over and there's no more terrorism. I know. Remember when the U.S. had a drug problem and then we declared a war on drugs and now you can't buy drugs anymore? It'll be just like that. Right. God. If only that war on drugs hadn't been so effective, I could really use some f***ing marijuana right now. Okay. And this is also from October 9th. Now, October 9th, of course, was 48 hours after we began Operation Enduring Freedom, which began, of course, with bombing Afghanistan. And like I said, I had posted these comics to my website. Now, I had a website prior to Get Your War On, but it was the home to just a couple apolitical, goofy comics that I used to just make in my spare time for kicks. And I was going to update my website that night, but I kind of just felt like it was totally ridiculous and stupid to continue with these kind of like apolitical comics in light of everything that was going on around me, especially since I felt, at least, like no one really seemed to be talking about what Operation Enduring Freedom would feel like for the people on the ground, which is, of course, the innocent civilians of Afghanistan. Most of them had no stake in the war against America or the war on terrorism, but of course they were one of the most heavily mined and poverty-stricken countries in the world, which had been suffering from drought for 4 years. And we were beginning to bomb them. And I kind of got this feeling that nobody really cared about what it would be like for the Afghans. People were pretty gung-ho to start the war on terrorism, of course, you know, as I was. Who wouldn't want to fight a war on terrorism? But anyway, and so looking around or, like, listening to, you know, whatever, Jay Leno, whoever, say monologues and joke about Osama bin Laden having sex with a camel, it's all well and good, but I just kind of felt like there was a missing... they weren't really doing justice to like the horror of the situation in Afghanistan, so that's why I started making these comics, kind of. Okay, and this is has always been one of my favorites from that first night's work. He says, "You know what I love? I love how we're dropping food aid packages into a country that's one big minefield. That's good. Well, it turns the relief effort into a fun game for the Afghan people. It's a game called See If You Have Any Arms left to eat the food we dropped after you step on a landmine trying to retrieve it." Right. Or maybe they could play, "See if when you step on the landmine, the food package flies into your decapitated head as it sails through the air." It's always been my favorite strip, so that's why I decided to donate all the money to these guys working in Afghanistan to clean up both the landmines and the unexploded cluster bombs that we dropped on them. Okay. Of course, in the fall of 2001, I was living and working in New York City. It was a horrific time to be there, but it was also, in a way, like really inspirational and I don't know what the word is. But anyway, I was in my own way, I was kind of grateful to be there during those days. But it did lend itself to a lot of kind of like wacky situations. He says, "There's one thing I love to see. It's a huge SUV tooling through midtown Manhattan with an American flag flying half-mast on its antenna. What could be less French?" That's right, supersize the grief. When we get our grief on, we grieve harder than anyone. Mother just can't grieve like the USA. And now the world knows how the big dogs grieve. Who wants to grieve with the big dogs? Afghanistan, do you like grieving with the big dogs? Iraq, you can get your little flags ready. Actually, does anyone other than Saddam Hussein even get to own a car over there? Okay. What I'll do now is show you a strip that I never actually posted to the website, but it is in the book, and then I'll show you some supporting documentation, which is quite remarkable. So this is, again, from October of 2001. This guy says, "Whenever I feel depressed, I take solace in my favorite corporate condolences ad. It's Philip 66 in the New York Times. It's written from the perspective of angels up in heaven." And the lady is reading from the ad. She says, "May you feel our arms around you this day and every other. You should see the light burning in your hearts. Sincerely, the angels who keep you." The angels who speak to us via petroleum companies. What a bunch of patronizing wait a minute. Are the angels speaking to us supposed to be dead people from the World Trade Center? What the good goddamn hell are those Philip 66 bastards getting at? Now, I'm going to show you the ad. This ran in the New York Times in the fall of 2001, along with a bunch of other really amazing and remarkable ads. This one I thought was especially mystical. So you can tell, obviously, from the handwriting that an angel wrote this letter and sent it to us, to America, to Dear America. And it starts off, "May this letter find you in the warm embrace of each other," which was a safe bet. And anyway, it goes on, and the letter in and of itself is totally fine and inoffensive. I agree with it. It's just talking about the heroes of September 11th and, you know, everyone needs to stick together. That's fine. But then it ends in kind of like a weird way. It says, "Your love is so strong, you should see the light burning in your hearts." And then I don't know if you can see this. It says, "Sincerely, the angels who keep you." And then there's a... That's presumably the author of the letter. But anyway, this letter, as it appeared, and this is in the A section of the New York Times. I assume you know how much it costs to take out a full-page ad in the A section of the New York Times. It costs like $6 billion. Only angels can afford to do like that, right? But anyway, it says... I always just thought it was so weird that it was signed sincerely, because you have to remember this is a letter sent from heaven to a country which had just suffered an unjustified and totally devastating terror atrocity. And I assumed that it would be signed like with best wishes or like here with you in your moment of sorrow, the angels. Instead they signed it sincerely like it's from the phone company or something. And that's when I got suspicious, like maybe there's too much like a business. It smacks of a business letter. Maybe an angel didn't write it. And sure enough, what we have here, I don't know if you can make that out, is the seal of, not of the Archangel Gabriel, believe it or not, but of Phillips 66, which is an international petroleum company. And I just want to show one other ad that ran in the New York Times in the fall of 2001. Now, this ad was placed by Royal Caribbean. I don't know if you can read it. Well, you know what? I'll read it aloud. This letter appeared also in the A section of the New York Times, and it says down at the bottom here, "It would take a really large ship to hold all the emotions we're feeling for New Yorkers. Fortunately, we have one. We're honored to launch Adventure of the Seas, the world's largest cruise ship, right here in New York Harbor." And then it has this Royal Caribbean's logo right there. Now, what this is, I don't know if you can read it, but this boat is this huge boat. And it's so big that it hosts all these emotions on the boat. And what they've provided us with is the passenger manifest. And you can kind of see, well, back here in the back of the boat, for instance, we have pride, admiration, and awe are riding on the boat. And then up at the front, down here, they have the emotions introspection and patriotism and whatever. The boat is filled with emotions. The only thing that I want to point out, I always like to point this out because it kind of gives away the game, as they say, is that if you look on the fifth column from the left on the top, they have this emotion here, gratitude. You can't tell, but gratitude is down here in like this cocktail lounge area. And then, that's fine. And then third column from the left on the bottom, though, they have this emotion called grateful, who's up by the pool. Well, you're college students. You know that gratitude and grateful is the same damn emotion. It's just a different grammatical form. It's like registering twice on the boat using an assumed name or something. You know what I mean? And what I think is amazing is that it gives it away. The boat is actually too big. They ran out of emotions for New Yorkers, and so they started to fake it and fudge it and use the same emotion twice, which is really amazing, I think. And the only other thing that I want to point out is at the front of the boat here, there's three emotions: faith, hope, and charity. Now, faith is down here in the auditorium. Hope is, I guess, the captain driving the boat. But then charity, look where charity is. It's on this helicopter landing pad at the front of the boat. Now, this stupefied me. For like 5 minutes, I was looking at this newspaper advertisement like, why charity? Why is charity at the front of the boat on the helicopter landing pad? Of course, until I remembered 1 Corinthians in the New Testament. I think it's Paul's letters to the Corinthians, verse 13. And you go home tonight and look at your Bibles, it will be totally obvious why charity is on the helicopter landing pad. Okay, so that's that. I'm kind of like dwelling in the fall of 2001 because it was such an interesting time. And I just wanted to show a couple more from that period. So this is from October 14th of 2001. This is when it was really hitting the fan. In New York. He says, holy f***, anthrax in New York City. We're getting our f***ing ass kicked. Seriously, who the fuck are we fighting? Lex Luthor? When is the goddamn Death Star going to shoot that big-ass laser at us? I know, what's next? George W. Bush is going to hold a press conference and rip his face off, and it's going to be Ming the Merciless up under there? Jesus! Okay. Incidentally, I don't know, you guys were probably in class, but for those of us who are professional cartoonists, that is, we work in our sweatpants all day, at home, I listened to the press conference today with Bush and Blair. You know, Tony Blair, our girlfriend, was over here in the States because they're discussing, I guess quite heatedly, what the reconstruction of Iraq is going to look like. And anyway, they held a joint press conference today, Bush and Blair. And Bush did not rip his face off, unfortunately. Nevertheless, you like get this sense, like, you know, Tony Blair strikes me as a pretty well-spoken, well-reasoned guy, and he seems to have really, you know, whether or not you agree with his position vis-a-vis Iraq and the new face of whatever benign Western imperialism, he seems to make some effort to present like a coherent, articulate case for why we're doing what we're doing. And you get a sense of this when you watch him in, you know, in Parliament back in London, or when he goes on and faces a bunch of surly teenagers on British MTV, as I think he did a couple months ago. He seems to kind of like also try to do that with the press. Like he's trying to convince the press. George W. Bush, God love him. You just get this sense, like, of a sense of disdain for the institution of a free press. And today, like I said, he didn't rip his face off. But you just got this sense of, like, he just cannot stand having to answer to the press. I mean, the probing, like, incisive questions of the U.S. press will just not let go of his inconsistencies, right? But anyway, I don't know why I started talking about that. Okay, this is from October 30th of 2001. It's as true today as it was when I made it. The guy says, if you're not with us, you're against us, huh? I like it. It's so nice and simple. When do we start bombing Western Europe? And the guy says, oh, man, tell the boys down at the bomb-making factory to brew up more coffee. They're going to be working some serious goddamn overtime. This guy says, can't we just build a bomb the size of the Earth? And cut a hole out of the middle in the shape of the United States and drop the motherfucker around us and take care of business once and for all. Okay, and this one I'm going to show because I posted it about a month after we began Operation Enduring Freedom. This is kind of like a wrap-up of the operation so far. He says, you can see that it's like I was just getting so intoxicated with my internet power that I started to just rant. But anyway... He says, man, I like a good stiff Operation Enduring Freedom as much as the next guy, but I've reached my limits of understanding. All of a sudden, my f***ing mailman is a hero on the front lines of the war against terror. My daughter wants to sell cookies to help the people. My nephew's been sent to f***ing bomb. I'm supposed to help the FBI find clues and solve crimes. I'm a claims adjuster, not f***ing Encyclopedia Brown. Who's in charge of this s***? And this lady is frazzled. She says, agreed, this is totally Looney Tunes. I love that the fate of the world hangs in the balance. Bush is talking about conquering evildoers, yet the CIA can't translate the evildoers' Arabic voodoo spells. The Office of Homeland Security makes the DMV look like Delta Force. And look, I understand why Osama bin Laden sounds crazy. He's an 11-foot-tall motherfucker who lives in a cave. But why does Bush always sound like he's addressing a goddamn Dungeons and Dragons convention? At least I can tear my hair out full-time since I've been laid off. You can see that. That's around the time that I got laid off from my part-time job because of the economy, incidentally. Now I'm going to jump ahead months and months. These people are sitting around in their kitchenette and they're discussing the difference between Congress's role or Congress's attitude towards the electorate versus the attitude exhibited by one Dick Cheney. Who you know is our vice president. Anyway, and they're using the analogy of baseball. We're picking up this comic halfway through. Okay, so the lady with the donut says, I know what you mean. I used to think Congress would be a good team to play for. Then I watched them run to the steps of the Capitol to recite the Pledge of Allegiance, yelling out, under God, like the most annoying kid in Sunday school. Like, who are you trying to impress, the devil? F***ing get back to work and keep track of our wars. That's when I realized Congress is strictly farm league shit. They'd probably have a bald eagle contest if they thought it would impress us. Right. Whereas Dick Cheney, he's not trying to impress me. He's just minding his business. And that's why he will be the last man walking the scorched post-apocalyptic earth. God will fly down to pour the Gatorade on him. We started off the presentation this evening with these clip art cartoons from the 19th century to provide like a historical context for this tradition. And what I want to do now is show you some comics that I made in the 80s because they're kind of newly relevant to the Iraq situation with these weapons of mass destruction, you know, which is obviously on our minds. So these are some comics that I made back in the 80s when I was a budding young satirical cartoonist. And you can see that I wasn't as good at drawing my characters as I am now. Now it's like I just draw them like a robot. It's just like it's like Jim Davis with Garfield. He can just draw Garfield like with his feet, probably. But anyway, so it was a little rough around the edges, and the typography and the spelling was a little messed up. But it, you know, I was a young man. Okay, anyway. So what was I writing about back in those days? He says, "It's so weird that USA is friends with Saddam Hussein. What's his prob? He looks so angry. What is Ronald Reagan doing with that guy? Duh, USA plus Saddam equal BFF, best friends forever. We are helping him against Iran in a war to keep us safe. It's okay, now shut up. But what if he keeps using chemical weapons? Oh, wait, I forgot. We don't care. Sorry, Kurds, see ya, wouldn't want to be ya." And then they continue to bicker to and fro. I'll just show one more from this series. He says, "Okay, maybe you're right. We should stop Saddam Hussein before he says, 'Let's go crazy.' What should we do? Congress is going to pass a bill that says, 'Blank you, Saddam, for using the chemical weapons we helped you make, dude.' But Reagan did not want to offend him. Sorry, but what can you do? Those Kurds know what it sounds like when doves cry, I bet." And this guy says, this is a dream that you guys are too young to appreciate, but the guy says, "I hope Michael Dukakis..." I'm sure your parents have told you of this legendary political warrior, Michael Dukakis, sitting in that tank with that goofy-ass helmet on his head. But anyway, this guy says, "I hope Michael Dukakis can be our president and stop Saddam one day. Anyway, I've got to make some business deals now. See ya." Okay. It's not much, but I made it using a Nintendo 64 game system, so what are you going to do? Okay. This is a strip from September 27th of 2002. He says, "Well, it's been over a year and the president still can't seem to get around to firing someone for the September 11th attacks. I mean, was that somehow not the most colossal fuck-up imaginable? I don't care if you retroactively fire someone from the Roosevelt administration. Just let me know that if I can get fired for stealing coffee filters from the office kitchenette, some motherfucker and the government can get fired when 3,000 Americans are murdered in one morning. I'm supposed to trust you to wage new wars whenever you want, so start acting like you take this seriously. Saddam Hussein is dead meat," this guy says. Now, you guys know this news magazine. It's called Newsweek. It comes out once a week, and it concerns itself more or less with the news. And I bought it a couple weeks ago because there was an article that I wanted to read. I can't remember what it was, but they had a little... Newsweek has a little section at the front of their magazine where they just list tidbits of information. It's called Periscope, and recently they've caught some flack for breaking major news stories in this little section and then never following up with it. Well, anyway, they had this incredible story a few weeks ago. This is actually before the House submitted its budget for 2004. But the head, this guy who's been chosen to run the September 11th inquiry, the guy who replaced the benevolent Henry Kissinger. Anyway, I can't remember if he's a senator or a congressman or what, but he said, "Listen, I have to have more money to pursue the September 11th investigation because they had budgeted $3 million for this guy." And he said, "I want to try to get it up to $15 million. And Newsweek wrote, this is so awesome. Newsweek said, $15 million would be a substantial increase. It's still much less than the $50 million that they've budgeted to investigate the space shuttle tragedy." Now listen, I got choked up when I read about the space shuttle blowing up on re-entry. And I was a kid in eighth grade when the Challenger exploded. And that was also very traumatic. And listen, the bottom line is I'm not going to ride on a space shuttle. Like, I'm going to work in an office building in Manhattan. I don't, you should give some money to investigate the space shuttle. But for sake, like, get your priorities straight. Investigate international terrorism and whether it was the INS or the CIA or the FBI or the NSA. Like, how did this happen on September 11th? You know, and it's like they're devoting almost 20 times as much money to the foam on the wing of the space shuttle. It's amazing. Like, I open up the New York Times. I try to read the New York Times two or three times a week. You open it up, and the whole middle section is always like four or five pages of space shuttle research. What happened to the foam on the wing? What about this memo when they said that they knew the wing, you know, there was going to be damage with the foam? Why didn't they catch this? Blah, blah, blah. It's like, that's great, but you know what? Like, I really think that should be a sidebar. The main thing should be the fucking, like, how the September 11th attacks occurred. For God's sake. Sorry. Yeah. That's the kind of thing where it's like, yeah, that car ride was twice as long as I thought it was going to be. Wow. And all we ate was Cheez-Its and beef jerky. Woo! Okay. So this is from, we're almost done here. This is from September of 2002. This is obviously before we began Operation Iraqi Freedom. He says, remember those leftover civilians in that country where we waged our last war a few months ago? Do they realize they're one war away from being completely forgotten? Maybe the plan is to feed all the hungry Afghans using the bodies of dead Iraqis. If that's the case, let me just say one thing. I hope leftover Iraqis enjoy the taste of North Koreans. Okay. Bada bing. Hey, that's how the world works. You know, it's like, it's not my fault. You know what I mean? Okay, I'll just show this one just for fun. We made this one because we were getting so excited about North Korea. He says, this is straight, simple enough. North Korea, what the fuck is wrong with you? Seriously, what's up, North Korea? Why are you acting so crazy? And North Korea says, I don't know. It just feels so good when everyone is looking at me. Okay, so this is from January 19th of this year. It's like the clock is ticking on Iraq. And I don't know if you heard about this holiday that we celebrate in secret every year. Guy says, oh, shit, I totally forgot to send my daughter a Happy National Sanctity of Life Day card. You bum. Did you at least send a National Sanctity of Life Day food basket to some starving Iraqi children? I wanted to, but the store didn't have big enough baskets. Oh, yeah, sorry. National Sanctity of Life Day. This is actually the second year that we've celebrated it. It's not a big deal. You don't get the day off, obviously. But it's a holiday that was put into the congressional record or something. You know, they can have, like, I think they had, like, a Fred Rogers Day when Fred Rogers died. And they just put in all these little special happy days. A National Sanctity of Life Day is just this day where we're supposed to pause and remember the sanctity of every child on Earth from the moment of conception. I mean, you can see what the political, what the undercurrent for Happy National Sanctity of Life Day is, right? You know, whatever. So me and every other hack political cartoonist, you know, thought it would be so great to, like, explore the parallels between, whatever, kids who are alive and starving to death versus, like, these fetuses in the womb. Okay, now let's talk about this. So this was put up on February 10th of 2003, right after we learned that there was this thing called the Domestic Security Enhancement Act, which is like the Patriot Act 2 that John Ashcroft has been working on. Anyway, I put it up feigning ignorance that I didn't know about this act, and I got deluged with emails of people being like, your nightmares come true. It's like, no shit. Anyway, she says, sometimes I wish the Patriot Act was a little patrioter. Isn't there a way to beef it up? He says, I still can't believe they named that thing the USA Patriot Act. Grown-ups did that. Never forget that. I know, but wouldn't it be awesome if they came out with a Patriot Act that was even tougher? Could they do that somehow? He says, you think once they have Benjamin Franklin's body spinning in his grave fast enough, they'll be able to power an internal combustion engine with it? That would solve a bunch of problems all at once. Okay. This is the last one. This is from February of 2003. She says, remember when our president's dad, like, believe it or not, he was also a president, so crazy. She says, remember when our president's dad told Saddam Hussein's people to rise up against him and then played that funny joke where he allowed them to be slaughtered? She says, what a gas. Actually, you're thinking of when we supported Saddam's genocide against the Kurds. He says, all I know is Thomas Friedman said some people are about to get free. So if you know who Thomas Friedman is, I think he's won the Pulitzer three times. He's a New York Times columnist. This is the final rant of the evening. Thomas Friedman is I guess you would call him like a liberal, you know, like a centrist liberal or whatever. His whole thing is that we totally botched and bungled and blew our chance at waging like a legitimate, that is, multilateral war against Saddam Hussein. But now that we're in this crazy position, we should make the most of it and free the Iraqi people and make the world a better place. He's really into this theory of heal the world. Is his theory. I think he believes in like a benevolent, some kind of like benevolent system of American intervention to secure liberty and rights for everyone. But the guy is like so relentless, and he'll admit this, so relentlessly optimistic and always willing to look on the bright side of things and wish for the best and just hope against hope that Bush and Dick Cheney and Donald Rumsfeld, of all people, will somehow stick to their guns this time and actually follow through on the rebuilding of Iraq. That's it's a noble sentiment. Like, I hate feeling skeptical about the motives of my government because I pay them, you know, to do what they do. But at some point, I feel like that level of optimism in the face of so much history, especially the history concerning these actual guys over the past 20 years. It's not like this is a brand new administration, we have a clean slate, and these dudes are totally into helping the people in Iraq. Dick Cheney doesn't stay up late at night thinking about these skinny-ass Iraqi kids with nothing to eat. But anyway, for Thomas Friedman to sit there and just hope and hope and hope and, oh my God, President Bush, please read this editorial. You gotta stick to your guns this time. I think at some point that level of optimism becomes sort of offensive in a way. It's like a willful naivete. It's kind of like, dude, you're just like, it's like enabling someone. You know what I mean? It's like pretend you have a relative who's an alcoholic. And you also have this huge empty room with 600 full bottles of gin in it. It's like, God, you know, I hope when Uncle Joe goes into that empty room, like, I just really hope he won't, you know, drink any of that gin. It's like, well, you f***ing idiot. Get rid of the gin, for f***ing sake. You know what I mean? It's kind of like the same thing with this guy, Thomas Friedman. But anyway, I don't want to end on a negative note. Like, I hope it's right. Like, I hope we help out Iraq. You know, it'd be great. Maybe the people in Afghanistan will find some comfort in that. I don't know. But anyway, so that's more or less the end of it. It kind of disintegrated, but thanks a lot. I appreciate it. Thank you.
That was a talk by cartoonist David Rees, creator of Get Your War On. The talk was given last March at the University of Connecticut at Storrs and produced for radio by George King. This is Unwelcome Guests, and you're tuned to WEOS Geneva, WXXE Fenner Syracuse, W201CD Ithaca Community Radio, Free Radio Santa Cruz, or KFAR Knoxville. Next, we'll continue with readings from Disciplined Minds, a critical look at salaried professionals and the soul-battering system that shapes their lives by Jeff Schmidt, published in the year 2000 by Roman and Littlefield. We'll pick up in Chapter 8, which is titled Narrowing the Political Spectrum, with a subsection, Admission. Just about anyone with a bachelor's degree in physics, 4,000 are issued each year in the United States, or a related subject can, without much difficulty, apply and gain admission to a graduate program at a reputable university physics department. Nevertheless, 2/3 of the students receiving bachelor's degrees in physics do not continue toward the professional degree in physics. In fact, about half of the physics bachelor's degree recipients do not go to graduate or professional school in any subject, and so there is clearly a good deal of selection at the transition from undergraduate school to graduate school. The student's socioeconomic status is an important factor in this self-selection for graduate school. The working-class student, particularly the graduate of the four-year public college, tends to either be shut out socially, recognizing in advance that professional training is not for the likes of me, or shut out economically, being unable to enjoy the luxury of 5 or more years of freedom from the job market, usually because of family financial obligations. To get a PhD in physics requires an average of more than 6 years of graduate work. PhD-granting universities do not have the working-class atmosphere that exists at community colleges and at many public four-year colleges, where students often hold part-time or even full-time jobs. Universities are usually park-like and located in areas where rent is high and where working-class culture and lifestyles are out of place. UCLA, where I was an undergraduate, is typical of many such universities with large graduate departments. Located in the high-priced Westwood area of Los Angeles, the campus is a middle-class camp, a place where students with middle-class values can feel comfortable as they play and study. Campus facilities help maintain the middle-class atmosphere. For example, more than a dozen eating establishments, each with its own distinctive personality, decor, and menu, operate on the campus, offering more than 800 menu items. Health and indulgence are their two most prominent themes, as evidenced by their annual consumption of over 100 tons of lettuce, 54 tons of mozzarella cheese, and 27 tons of coffee beans. Thus, a yuppie in training can lunch at an outlet featuring a baked potato bar or a 70-item salad bar, and then just a short walk away, relax at a campus facility featuring gourmet cheesecake and fresh baked goods, gourmet coffees, and custom smoothies containing fresh fruit juice blended with your choice of 12 fruit options. Of course, not all campus facilities and services correspond to middle-class culture, but even those that do not are often vehicles for what any worker coming upon the campus scene would probably see as indulging in class privilege. Only middle-class students would have the time and the money. While working-class youth are spending their days at boring jobs or at high school-like two-year or four-year colleges, their middle-class age mates are off enjoying themselves at universities, which many fraternity and sorority members and other middle-class students treat as amusement parks, only with lecture halls instead of rides. A daytime walk across the UCLA campus, which is built on a plot of land more than four times the size of Disneyland, finds students crowding into large pinball and video game arcades, shooting pool in a room devoted to the activity, eating made-to-order pizza and hot German pretzels, buying fudge and 130 types of candy by the ounce, lining up for frozen yogurt sundaes and banana splits, keeping the attendant at an ice cream parlor busy scooping to fill their orders, busy enough, in fact, to make it one of the largest outlets of Baskin-Robbins ice cream on the West Coast, and choosing from 10 varieties of fresh-baked, hot-from-the-oven cookies, ranging from chocolate chip and peanut butter to chocolate mint and macadamia nut. Nor are the students' academic responsibilities forgotten in all the fun. Lecture notes for more than 100 large classes at UCLA are published weekly and sold at an often crowded office on campus, supposedly to allow the student to go to class and concentrate entirely on the lecturer's words. Even though graduate students are unable to spend as much time as undergraduates participating in all this, the activity does illustrate the middle-class orientation of the institutional culture in which all students and faculty work. A visitor to the UCLA campus senses almost immediately how working-class students, particularly working-class minority students, might feel out of place at the university. The discomfort that such students feel is similar to that felt by middle-class white students who wander into one of the campus's small enclaves of other cultures, such as the hallways, offices, and minority studies libraries near the Office of Equal Opportunity Programs. The affluent student is at home at the university. The working-class student is a visitor there. Thus, it is no surprise that a study of undergraduates at the University of California, Santa Barbara, found that the upscale institution's reputation as a party school stems from the practices of affluent white students only. These economically secure students are more likely to drink, use drugs, and party frequently, and are less likely to spend time studying than are minority students and working-class white students, the study found. Clearly, working-class students at working-class four-year colleges cannot usually make the transition to a university graduate school. This helps to explain why, even though admission to physics graduate school is easy for all, students with physics bachelor degrees from four-year colleges are much less likely than their university counterparts to become physics graduate students. Physics majors who work their way through college as undergraduates may find it difficult to continue on to the professional degree as part-time students. The University of California, Irvine, is quite open about this. In general, warns the university catalog, graduate study at the physics PhD program is expected to be a full-time activity. Other proposed arrangements should be approved by the graduate committee. Close quote. The application backs this up. Individuals seeking admission must answer the question, do you intend to pursue a full-time academic program at UCI? About 96% of the 10,000 physics graduates in the U.S. PhD granting departments are full-time students. The university discourages part-time physics graduate study not to reduce the number of working-class students, but rather to maintain the conditions that are necessary for professional training. Professional schools are not in the business simply to teach college graduates more facts and skills, but to teach values as well, to produce a particular kind of individual, the professional. To do this, the university must have its graduate students' undivided attention. The student most easily trained is the one whose body and mind are on campus, who has no mental foothold, point of reference, or source of critical distance outside his or her university department, and is therefore free to drift in the proper direction under the influence of the world values maintained by that department. Jobs, per se, are not the issue for the university. Indeed, the university itself gives half-time jobs in the physics department to most of the physics graduate students that it admits. The university's policy against part-time physics graduate students is really a policy against physics graduate students with off-campus jobs, students whose lives do not center on the campus. Whatever its primary purpose, discouraging part-time graduate study in physics does lower the number of working-class students who make the transition from undergraduate school to graduate school. And as I will explain, the half-time physics department jobs are not used to make up for this class bias in the selection of graduate students. Beginning graduate students who are given departmental employment are usually hired as teaching assistants, who do teaching and grading tasks that research-oriented faculty consider to be academic drudge work. Advanced graduate students are hired as research assistants. Physics departments can offer employment to most of the students they admit because military and industrial goals motivate large federal research budgets for physics, and the resulting contracts and grants have made physics departments among the richest on university campuses. Departments in the humanities and social sciences give financial support to fewer students and give less money to those that they do support, often by giving them fractional teaching assistant jobs. Even though the university pays graduate students only a fraction of what it pays faculty to do the same work, graduate students of all socioeconomic backgrounds who are offered these jobs take them eagerly. They do so either to save their parents money or to relieve themselves of the heavy burden of hustling money off campus while struggling in an academic program that demands total immersion for any reasonable chance of success. These jobs can mean the difference between success and failure as a graduate student. The fact that the jobs are clearly exploitative, but too important to give up, has helped to spur graduate student employees at many universities to unionize and strike. Physics departments and prospective physics graduate students know the importance of the jobs and think in terms of two fundamentally different kinds of admissions to graduate school, admissions with and without an offer of employment. Employment is usually bestowed on the basis of academic achievement. It is thus most likely to go to those who didn't have a job or a cultural conflict interfering with their undergraduate studies, students from the higher socioeconomic groups. Departments use the offers of employment to attract the students they think are best and who might otherwise go elsewhere. The academically average working-class student who gets no offer of employment, but who tries to attend graduate school anyway, is at a tremendous disadvantage with respect to a similar student from a middle-class family with financial resources. The extra burden of having to leave the department to earn money goes to the working-class student, helping to perpetuate that student's relatively low academic standing. This is an example of what the French sociologist Pierre Bourdieu describes as the university's tendency to transmute social hierarchies into academic hierarchies. To guide students to academic slots that correspond to the socioeconomic slots from which they come. Whether the class bias in admission to PhD programs is deliberate or merely a side effect of the university's efforts to maintain the conditions necessary for effective professional training, the university needs the bias if it is to operate anywhere near its present efficiency. Middle-class students are simply easier than working-class students to train as professionals. They're not smarter. Their attitudes and outlooks simply need less adjustment to meet the system's demands. And I'm reading from Disciplined Minds, a critical look at salaried professionals and the soul-battering system that shapes their lives by Jeff Schmidt, published in the year 2000. I'm reading from Chapter 8, Narrowing the Political Spectrum, continuing with the next subsection titled Courses. Beginning physics graduate students must devote an entire year or two of their lives to homework. Indeed, the first part of physics graduate school is well described as a boot camp based on homework. One characteristic of any boot camp is that the subject matter the instructors present in their day-to-day work is not really the main thing they are teaching. Teaching the subject matter is certainly one goal, but it is not the main one. In military boot camp, for example, drill instructors make recruits spend large amounts of time learning to dress to regulation, march to precise formation, chant ditties, disassemble and reassemble rifles, carry heavy backpacks, and so on. Yet the main goal of all this is something much more profound: to create soldiers who will follow orders, even to their deaths. Similarly, the most apparent goal of graduate physics courses is to indoctrinate the students into the dominant paradigms or theoretical frameworks of physics. But the primary goal is to train physicists who will maintain tremendous discipline on assigned problems. During the first 2 years in physics graduate school, students take a fairly standard set of courses. These courses, which are up to a year in length, include the following. And then Schmidt here lists a number of courses and their descriptions, which I will abbreviate by merely telling you that these courses include classical mechanics, electricity and magnetism, quantum mechanics, mathematical physics, and thermodynamics and statistical physics. And continuing on, the same textbooks are used in universities throughout the United States for most of these courses. Fashion changes so slowly that professors often teach from the same texts that they used as students. A year-long graduate physics course typically uses a single textbook. So the student's entire collection of graduate-level textbooks may take up only a couple of feet of shelf space. As familiar as the faculty and students are with these books, they might not be able to tell you their titles, because they almost always refer to the book by the author's last names. That's in Jackson. Let's look in Sicherny. Does anyone here have Goldstein? Here, physicists are referring to the texts Classical Electrodynamics, Modern Quantum Mechanics, and Classical Mechanics, respectively.